Welcome to Arrows on Air, presented by Tomorrow's Air. I'm Christina Beckman, and this is a show about the other sides of climate action. Here we learn from the fascinating experiences of adventurers, artists, storytellers, and scientists who help show us not only the how of climate action, but also why it's worth the effort.
Hello and welcome. In today's episode, I'm chatting with Suzanne Boma, Head of Partnerships and Programs Aviation at Neste. Neste is the world's leading producer of sustainable aviation fuel. The company is also developing chemical recycling to help in the global fight against plastic waste. In the past, Suzanne worked as Market Development and Partnerships Manager at Rainforest Alliance, and she's also spent a decade in management consulting with PwC and World Bank. I got to know Suzanne through the relationship Tomorrow's Air has with Neste. We share the same notion that it is possible to aggregate travel demand for sustainable aviation fuel, thereby expanding its use. Travel businesses can now partner with Tomorrow's Air to easily include SAF, as it's called, in their trip offerings, and travelers can purchase directly through the website. I'm going to spend a couple minutes here at the start of this episode to lay out some of the key topics in sustainable aviation fuel, or SAF. So bear with me. This will help bring context to this conversation if you are new to the subject. So why all the interest in SAF? Well, it delivers up to an 80% greenhouse gas emission reduction over conventional jet fuel. This is calculated by taking into account the entire life cycle of the fuel, from raw material extraction to consumption, and comparing it to similar emissions from fossil jet fuel. At this point, SAF accounts for less than 1% of global jet fuel demand. This is because it is much more expensive today than fossil-based jet fuel. With roughly 100,000 airline flights every single day, aviation contributes more than 2% of global carbon dioxide emissions. Of aviation's emissions, 71% come from commercial passenger travel, demand for which is growing at a breakneck speed. The World Travel and Tourism Council predicts the number of travelers will grow on average by just under 6% annually to 2032. So think about this. In 1960, 100 million people traveled by air. By 2019, the total annual worldwide passenger count was 4.5 billion. Imagine this, and growing. Of course, it's not just leisure travel we're talking about when it comes to aviation. Air travel is a pillar of modern transport networks for goods and people. And sustainable aviation fuel is widely regarded as a key solution. Increasing fuel production is a top objective. A couple policy points that I'll bring up here in case you haven't heard about these. In 2021, the Biden administration announced a SAF Grand Challenge, a plan to power aviation entirely with 35 billion gallons of biofuels. Advocacy groups have been working to ensure that this plan, along with provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act to accelerate SAF production, do not incentivize the widespread use of fuels made from corn crops and soy. This is a key topic, of course. What is the source for this magical fuel? What are all these feedstocks? Is the feedstock corn? Corn-based fuels divert land that would otherwise be used to grow food we eat, destroying wildlife habitat in the process. So that's not great. A 2022 study funded in part by the Department of Energy found that corn-based ethanol is overall worse for the climate than gasoline. Is the source of the fuel waste fats? Suzanne and I talk about this in our conversation. Or does it come from some other place altogether? Maybe from the air, from carbon dioxide harvested from the atmosphere, another angle that's being explored. The International Council on Clean Transportation says that synthetic fuels, or e-fuels, could play a larger role. They're made from hydrogen and captured carbon dioxide and can drastically reduce the climate impact if these two ingredients are sourced cleanly. The process does require massive amounts of electricity, another element to consider in all this. Where does the energy to power a biofuels production plant come from? Is it fossil fuels? If it is, then that can cancel out carbon savings. Battery-powered electricity would be the cleanest option for aviation, but this technology is also still young. Large batteries are heavy and may never work for longer flights. I learned in all this that a sustainable aviation fuel can cost $300 to $500 million to build. Think also of the trained workforce required and all the materials. It is a massive undertaking. When we purchase SAF, even in small amounts, we are sending a signal to producers that there is a market for it, that people want it, that we care and we understand, and that the investment in increasing capacity, which will have to come from many sources, will not be wasted. This is a somewhat technical discussion, but with Suzanne as a messenger, I think you'll find it inspiring and interesting. From her childhood on a houseboat in the Netherlands to her current position with Neste, she brings a practicality and optimism to this complex topic that I really appreciate. Suzanne, let's start with, just right off the bat, what is sustainable aviation fuel? How do you describe it? I know how I would describe it, but you do it.
Right. Trying to not go into the major technical league here, but sustainable aviation fuel, as I would describe it, is an alternative to fossil fuels that is made from waste and residue materials and delivers the exact same result. So it powers engines of aircraft.
It's so great. I mean, the concept of it, it feels to me like when I first heard about sustainable aviation fuel, I was like, oh, our problems are solved. Let's just use that. I know it's more complex than that. Like, describe, I remember being in one meeting with you when you had this incredible picture of sucking the waste fat out of behind some, describe where these waste residues, and I think that's like a new word for people. We don't know how animals, anyway, describe what that source feedstock material is.
Yeah, in our world, we call it feedstocks, but you can also refer to them as the ingredients or of SAF or the foundation, basically what's needed to then turn the molecules into something that can go into an engine. And yes, I showed you that picture because I think it's super powerful to show what we actually use as the ingredients for SAF. So in that picture, maybe I'll try and describe it for those that didn't see it. We see sort of the back of an average big food chain or restaurant, and there's a truck behind it that is sort of sucking out the frying fat that this restaurant has been using, presumably for a number of weeks or months. I don't know exactly how often they change this. And then there's a picture up close of the detail of what this grime then looks like. So this is pretty dirty stuff. It's bits of food floating into it. And this was really a couple of years or maybe a decade ago. This was really waste that would just be incinerated. It had no other purpose. And of course, since the start of then the renewables that are made from these products, we can, again, add value to what this waste ultimately is at the moment. So that's, I think, perhaps in some visual terms, what was in that image and also what it represents ultimately is something circular. So something that is regarded as waste or that we would have thrown away, we can take it back and turn it into a fuel that can power aircraft again.
And you have, so there's a lot of, as I mean, similar, we're, I think people are familiar with how we have to refine what we extract from the ground to turn it into fuel. We also have to refine these waste materials to turn them into fuel, right? So can you say a little bit more about, or actually anything, because I didn't even ask you, like what, talk about Neste and the trajectory this company has been on, because you're with a visionary sort of entity now, I think, right?
Yeah, I can talk a little bit about our beginnings. Neste is now a 75 years old company, originally a regional oil refiner based out of Finland that was at the time already very much used and geared towards using very dirty products, so to say, very low grade, to be able to turn that back into products that ultimately consumers could use. So I guess based on that history, we then fast forward perhaps to the mid-2000s, where Nesta said firmly, we need to move away from fossil and into renewables. And that capability of turning really waste or really dirty things into something that can be used again is at the center of what we do so well. And of course, the foundation of the renewable products that we have out in the market today.
And how many, what is a refinery? Our colleague, one of our colleagues did a refinery tour, and I've actually been, some of our colleagues in Asia have been talking with Singapore Neste team and suggesting we should have an Adventure Connect in Singapore and do a refinery tour. But what happens in, what does a refinery look like? What happens in there? I think it'd be good to do one.
Yeah, the first time I visited our Rotterdam facility, I haven't had the pleasure of visiting the Singapore one up close, but obviously we opened that mid last year as the world's largest refinery of sustainable aviation fuel. And what you essentially see when you're on the property here in Rotterdam, you can walk around and sort of smell the feedstock. So you have this smell around you of, yeah, frying fat. It's quite pleasant, actually. I mean, perhaps the black image that one might have of a traditional fossil refinery is very dirty, very black smoke and so on. But when you walk around in one of our refineries, you have this food smell that's around you and lots of pipes, lots of very complicated technical processes that take place to ultimately get the fries out of the waste and then turn it from one into another. And then there's traditional refining process that happens to create either the diesel or then the sustainable aviation fuel in this case.
Hmm. So does it put you in the mood for a hamburger and french fries?
It certainly shouldn't put people off because, I mean, that's currently, of course, one of the feedstocks that we rely on to make our sustainable aviation fuel, but not the only one, of course, because we can't eat enough hamburgers and fries to fly all aircraft around the world. So that should also be said.
Right, right. I remember reading an article or a report that and it broke down the different types of feedstocks for sustainable aviation fuel into categories. There was agriculture, there was, I can't even remember the whole list, but what are sort of the key buckets? Because animal residues and waste fats is just one category. And they're also exploring new kinds of ways to create it, right? New innovations are cropping up for a source.
Correct. So at Nesta, I mean, we're very proud that about 25% of our colleagues work in R&D because we also know what we have today is not sufficient and we need to continue to innovate. There is no such thing as a silver bullet also on the feedstock side. So what we're using today are these waste and residues that I've just described, indeed the used cooking oil or the frying fat and then the animal waste fats. But we're also looking at if you can get the same kind of molecules that are required for fuel from algae or from forestry waste or from domestic waste. And there are already some pilots ongoing to see, you know, where that next feedstock or multiple feedstocks. Because if you ask me, I mean, we will not make SAF one way. There will be multiple streams of waste and residues or alternative sources that can be used as the ingredients for SAF. And then one that some people might have heard of already is the popular power to liquid, where, I mean, if you really simplify it, you capture carbon from the air and then you would turn it back into a fuel. That technology already exists, however, is reliant on using a huge amount of energy. Of course, that should then be green energy, as well as, of course, green hydrogen that's required. And these are sort of more systemic energy transition changes that will need to take place before this technology can really achieve its scale. But yeah, that's some of the future music, I guess, that's out there already.
Yeah. Well, I like knowing about that because sometimes, you know, when you're in a situation, when I'm in a situation and somebody across from me will say, one of the things that I have heard a couple times, once at a picnic for my son, one of the dads was like, somehow we got into this, is it'll never scale. Well, it'll never scale. And I remember hearing that, you know, when we first started supporting direct air capture through Tomorrow's Air, and people would say, yeah, that'll never scale. And it is, it has the sense of, in that moment, of kind of shutting you down. You sit back and, but tell me how you respond to that, because it feels like, of course, as it is, you know, this is how we are today, but everything can shift and grow. And so you just described, I think, the pathways to scale, but is that, am I reading that right?
Yeah, correct. And I'm not a believer that there's one solution that will ultimately help us solve the bigger problem that we're facing here, and that's our reliance on this fossil fuel in terms of propelling our cars or our aircraft forward. Of course, there is a role for perhaps the electric aircraft. Will that be major? Will that be long distance? I don't know, but maybe ultimately not. There is talk of ultimately hydrogen for aircraft. Maybe there's a role for that. Is that the only solution? Maybe not. I think there is a huge role for using the technology that we have today that works and also requires very little infrastructure changes, which is SAF, because it can use the same pipelines, the same storage. It can be mixed into the existing fuel that we use today, but it's just a much better alternative. And I get that challenge also quite often, you know, there will never be enough. I mean, our estimate at the moment is that with that current feedstock, we could already displace about 10% of the global needs for the fossil kerosene. That's significant, but that's not enough. That's why we need other feedstocks and other pathways. And at the same time, it's so easy to say it will never scale, because that's then an excuse to do nothing. And what I think is ultimately really not the scenario that we want is that we continue with what we have today for infinity. So we need to look for a mix of solutions, not one, but a multitude of those. And that can be a combination of any sort.
Mm-hmm. How did you, Suzanne, get into this? I know when you and I first really got to know each other a little bit at that conference in Japan, and we're talking about our families, and I realized we're both moms. We both, you know, had a background in consulting. What was the shift in your life that got you into fuel?
Yeah, good question. I think the red thread in my work life has always been some form of sustainability. And yes, I spent a long time at a big four and loved that time. But always was looking at the sort of next solution and so forth. And of course, in a consulting world, you deal mostly with paper and advice and recommendations. And it was very clear to me that I wanted to continue making an impact with my skill set, with my knowledge, with the way I look at things in a sustainability ecosystem or setting, but that I wanted to be working on a real product. Not to say that, of course, the papers are not important, but I wanted to make sure that I could lend those skill sets also to something real that was addressing a problem that I think we are all seeing around us.
So it was an intentional kind of shift to like, now I'm going to go look for a job in sustainability, and then
Not maybe so deliberate. So when I realized that my time at my previous job had sort of come to an end, which I also really enjoyed, by the way, I knew I wanted to move to industry. And what kind of industry I left open at the time. And then Nesta and I found each other. And I've been super happy to be able to be part of the story for the last 2.5 years or so. And just seeing the amount of synergies with my previous experiences in different organizations and bringing that to life really in what I do today.
Where did you grow up?
So I grew up on a houseboat the middle of in the middle of the Netherlands, born and raised there. So I was always outdoors, playing, building tree houses, rowing or teaching myself how to row. So really the appreciation, I guess, for nature was there from a very early age. Also one of my earliest memories, I guess, is just looking at these World Wildlife Fund picture books with my grandfather. So just the natural world, I guess, was always there as a sort of an anchor or an element that was part of my very early childhood already.
Where I live near Sausalito, where there are a lot of houseboats, and I've been on them a couple times, and it is a very distinctive vibe. I mean, it's a house; it's all organized like a house. Yet it has, you do feel that's so amazing. So, what are your parents like? Intellectual hippies, or
those days, definitely. Yeah. Yes, I mean, they probably bought the house in the late 70s, early 80s, and those days it was really sort of the next best up from a trailer. And I think that view has changed since then, because now we don't refer, at least in the Netherlands, we don't refer to these places anymore as a houseboat, but they're called water villas, which already gives a quite different vibe to it. But yeah, it was a different way of living. Maybe disconnected, or at least it was not, you know, a house in the street. I remember it always attracted lots of little friends from my class that just wanted to see, you know, what is this like, you know, and being close by the water and the garden by the water and, you know, the wildlife that we had around us was really precious.
I always regard Dutch people as very practical. And I think I took a lot of encouragement from the fact that Neste and you are also so optimistic. I mean, I think sometimes I, you know, there's a criticism out there or a skepticism around people who are on the front end of supporting new innovations and new ideas. And a lot of times I will sort of be checking myself, like, maybe I am too naive. Maybe this is kind of a pipe dream, but then I met you and I was like, look at this grounded, practical woman. And she feels the same way. What do you think about that?
Yeah. Maybe the first point I would say, there's still such a big role for individual vision, passion, and believing in that it is possible to make things a reality. Without that, and without that bigger sort of helicopter view and the bigger picture that we're all trying to work towards, it's hard to sometimes see your way through. But I mean, when we speak to our clients or you, I mean, we really see people who take a 20-30 or 20-50 kind of view. And for those kind of long goals, we need to start today. And in a very simple, pragmatic way, work our way towards reaching that goal. And I think before we also chatted about Norway and, you know, the transition away from fossil fuel powered cars into completely electric cars. I mean, those are, of course, it's a different sector. And we're talking about completely different vehicle, but ultimately, I mean, it is possible to make that transition happen with the right kind of drivers. And those drivers are ultimately the consumer and the government, but also, of course, the providers of ultimately the solutions that need to be made available to that market.
Suzanne, what's the demand for sustainable aviation fuel in context with fossil-based jet fuel? The whole idea here with Tomorrow's Air and our partnership is that we can help spread understanding and awareness for sustainable aviation fuel and start to build demand for it, which will hopefully increase the production, increase the distribution. Can you put that in context for us? What's the percentage demand for SAF in context with fossil-based jet fuel today?
Yeah, I think the overall jet fuel consumption, and I don't know if this is a pre-COVID number, is roughly around 300 million tons every day. If we're flying around the world, then we need, I think my colleague calculated it, 12,500 liters per second of jet fuel is consumed. And out of that, indeed, under 1% is sustainable aviation fuel today. But I think with, of course, the efforts that we're making, but also that others are making at the moment, we should start seeing a change to a number over the single digit, hopefully very soon. And that can only happen if we have, of course, the capacity in place to produce, which I think at least on our side, and we have worked really hard to do so with the opening of the Singapore refinery last year, but also the consumer confidence that this is a good alternative and is something that you need to think about when you're traveling. Fuel isn't necessarily probably the most sexy part of your trip that you're thinking about, but how is it different from, you know, the choice that you make for how you travel from the choice that you make in the supermarket on what to buy and put on your sandwich? And that's maybe the sort of history that I carry with me from working very briefly at the Rainforest Alliance, which deals with coffee and cocoa and trying to ensure that becomes more sustainable. Why don't we have the same attachment to fuel? And it has to do with that, you know, you don't quite see it. You don't quite go and buy, you know, your kerosene in the supermarket. There's a distance between that concept and perhaps your trip that you're trying to book.
Yeah. I think one of the things that you and I also bonded on was this notion of a consumer movement, you know, that the session I was in last week, we also kind of were exploring this topic. Like, what is the potential? Where does the leverage come from? Do we have to wait for governments? Do we have to wait for large corporates? I feel sometimes like I'm trying to short circuit because those things are taking too long and I need to get busy now. And so we're reaching to kind of build consumer awareness and a consumer movement. How do you look at the interplay? Obviously, we need all those things, but what do you feel about consumers?
I feel they ultimately hold a huge amount of power and probably more than they might realize. But look at, the power of consumers to either make or break a brand. There's this possibility now also with the way we are interconnected and the way news travels very fast. I mean, if there is a brand that is taking a certain direction, which its consumer base really doesn't like, they're very quick to respond. And in the same way, if we see new products or new services being brought into the market that really tick, you know, what consumers are looking for, then that can grow extremely fast. So our recent report also by one of the big consulting firms that consumers are willing to pay about 10% more for more sustainable products. But that can only be done, of course, if they are offered to them and if they're aware that these products exist and they have enough confidence in them. Because let's also not forget that that there's a lot to do with, you know, how things are presented and perceived and how credible things are and aren't you being greenwashed and so forth. And that's a balancing act that I think we need to not forget in order to be credible, to show the solutions, to show the impact, also the limitations, because that's just what it takes to be real and credible in order to get that consumer movement going. And it's happened in other places and other products. And so why not for a more sustainable travel?
Yeah, I think so. I think so, too. What do you have, like an example product that you lean on mentally as like, we want to be like that? Like when I think of Tomorrow's Air, I want Tomorrow's Air to be like 1% for the planet, a mark that's recognizable to a consumer and that, you know, we're reaching consumers can sign up on their own, but really most of the consumer interaction is coming through the connection with travel companies, with brands. Is there something in the SAF universe when you think of a product that has scaled or gained kind of recognition that is your go-to example for SAF?
Yeah, interesting. I could I could go with two answers, and they're from quite different products. I mean, I already mentioned the electric vehicle. I mean, what maybe a lot of people may not know is that even in 2022, with our renewable products, we avoided or reduced as much CO2 as Tesla did with the manufacturing of their electric vehicles. So everyone knows Tesla, of course, but not maybe everyone just knows Nesta. Meanwhile, we're responsible for almost creating the same amount of impact. That said, I also touched earlier on this emotional connection. And of course, there's a much more emotional connection already to a very good looking car. But if you think about something that you use on a daily basis and it's not, you know, a quite big purchase, then you need to think about perhaps what's in your kitchen cabinet and something you use on a much more regular basis, coffee or I don't know, chocolate.
Yeah.
And I guess when people or some people make a purchasing decision, you do watch what you're buying.
I think of like Intel Inside, like the microchip, you know, they're like people are using computers all the time, but they're not thinking about how those are up and the effort that they made to actually bring that forward was very smart. And I think that's some of what is our opportunity here with fuel. I have a couple more personal questions, Suzanne, around your family life and what you have a couple of kids. How old are they? And then I also want to ask you questions about cooking and music.
Oh, nice.
Well, first the kids.
Yeah. So I have two kids, one boy and one girl, Blake and Ava. Blake is 9 and Ava just turned 6. They are super high energy. They also come home with questions sometimes that they get in the class around, you know, sustainable choices. Recently, I had a discussion with Ava about, you know, what kind of eggs do you need to buy? Because at least in the Netherlands, they have a certain star rating. So, you know, one star is a chicken in a very small coop, and 3 star is sort of the outdoor chicken. And well, with her at that time, 5 years of age, I was pretty impressed that she was going to advise me in the supermarket about what kind of eggs we should now be eating from now onwards, because that was something that was discussed in class. Now, if I reflect back to my, you know, first years in primary school, these were not topics that were
not
discussed.
Not even remotely a topic.
No. So just the fact that these topics are being discussed at a primary school level at a rather young age, and it's not just her, also my son, I mean, he knows in simple terms what it is that I do for a job, and he can explain that to his peers, and he's proud of that. He feels that I'm making a small contribution to helping, you know, reduce all the bad air that is going around. So, of course, they do miss me every now and then, and sometimes I still wonder, you know, if my key will still fit my door because I'm away quite a bit also. But yeah, they form also a huge piece of why I'm doing what I'm doing, because I hope that, you know, when they are entering the job world, that we will only have sustainable companies to work for.
Yeah, I feel the same way. My son also is learning many, many, I mean, they touch on everything. They're learning about the ocean. They're learning about, yeah, how a lot of conversations around circularity and recycling. And also in San Francisco, we have a, you know, thing going on with plastics, and are the plastics really being recycled? And you think they're being recycled, but they're not. And then also, by the way, all this plastic is made from fossil fuel based materials. And so the notion that that fossil fuels are just everywhere in everything is starting to like absorb into his realities, like your clothes, these plates.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah.
And so when you come home after a long day, who's doing the cooking? Is that you or your partner or your kids?
All of the above, Christina. Mm. So I really enjoy cooking or baking, but I don't find a lot of sort of moments of peace to do so apart from the weekend. That said, I mean, I try and work from home a couple of days during the week. So then if I finish on time, then I do the cooking. But the general rule is that my partner takes care of the dinner. And only recently, a couple of weeks ago, my son tried his hands on making a little pasta with some sauce. And he was super proud that he was able to pretty much do it all by himself. So I hopefully soon have someone else who can also, you know, get into the kitchen. But that said, it's really also a way for me to maybe step away from all this big complexity and these huge topics that I deal with on a daily basis and just do something really simple with my hands. So I once tried my hands on making croissants from scratch. I haven't done that in a long time, but you know, that gives me also a lot of joy and sort of energy to keep going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Same. I think sometimes it's all just, yeah, it's too much. I do think we are living in a very exotic moment of transition, like massive transition that I don't think my parents, I mean, maybe, I don't know. My dad and my grandfather were both involved in oil exploration. And so I know for them, it was like this, there was a huge transition happening, but it was an exciting, they weren't, although now we look back, you know, the heads of those companies did know the polluting effects of what they were doing. But I think the, you know, the folks at my parents' level were not, they were just excited. They were, yeah. So what we're after, I think our effort has a weight to it that might be a little heavier. Okay. Well, it's been 30 minutes. I know you have it busy. It's the middle of the day for you. This is the first of my, I have to say, this is the first podcast I've ever done before 7 a.m. So thank you for bearing with me. I just need I have two final questions, and one is around music. What kind of music do you listen to? And you'll have to follow up and send me some songs to go on your playlist. And then why don't you send us off with like what's on the horizon for Neste this year?
Good. Music first. It really depends on my mood. So you'll get from me a selection of what my mood has been over the last few weeks. I really enjoy a piece of classical music in the background. Actually, I mean, my husband and I have had our radio on a classic station for probably the last 3 months. And that's super soothing and lifting the spirits. But when I'm working, I also enjoy something a bit more upbeat. And then since we're a little bit of a mixed family, we also do have something with a beat and a rhythm that comes into play every now and then. So it really depends, but I'll send you some titles.
Good. Yes. When I work, sometimes I have to put on, John and I share a wall, and he's on calls all day and I'm on calls all day. And so I will listen to like electronic focus. And sometimes I feel like I've lost. I'm like, I don't know who's playing this. I don't know what these instruments are. It's very different from like going home and selecting a record and like choosing something. Okay, well, good. I will look forward to that. And tell me Neste is in so many, I see Neste SAF in a lot of places. So you are doing a good job in partnerships, but what are you hoping for this year?
Yeah, what's next? Really excited, especially the coming couple of weeks, since we've been, of course, supporting a number of organizations, including yours and some of your members with sustainable aviation fuel. We are stepping out onto an even bigger stage at the beginning of March in London, where we will be unveiling also the solution that we've had in store for quite some time now to a larger corporate audience, and really celebrating also that, because there is a lot of sort of, it's not enough and it's only 1% and, you know, it can't scale. But let's also recognize where we've come from. 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 10 years ago, no one would have thought that this was even remotely possible. So lots of positivity, lots of optimism in store, and just a continued vision towards getting this job done together. And then that's really at the core of the partnerships, of course, that we create value on both sides.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to that. You know, every time it shows up, every time your Neste brand shows up aligned with some larger I don't know, entity that somehow in it feels like it has greater leverage than we do, it's great to be able to point to that and say, look, you're not alone. It's not just a grassroots effort of, you know, getting travelers together. It's also connected to a much bigger machine that's also moving forward. Thank you, Suzanne. I'm going to...
Thank you.